This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Samantha Donovan. This Friday, experts call for calm as a woman dies with blood clotting after receiving the AstraZeneca vaccine. And for the residents of Kalbarri in WA, the cyclone clean-up is gathering pace.
The SES have done a wonderful job in starting to clean it up. There's still a lot of rubbish around, so things are starting to move, but the asbestos issue is a big problem. People's backyards are full of it, of other roofs and stuff.
First today, as authorities fight to maintain public confidence in Australia's vaccination program, health experts are warning people not to jump to conclusions after the blood clot-related death of a woman in her 40s. It comes as the head of Pfizer suggests a third dose of its jab will most likely be needed for adequate protection against the COVID virus. Australia, as we know, is relying on imported doses of the Pfizer vaccine for the rollout here. National Cabinet will meet on Monday to discuss just how to get Australia's troubled vaccine rollout back on track. Sarah Sedgie has the latest.
The Pfizer vaccine currently requires two doses for protection against COVID-19. But now the pharmaceutical giant's chief executive says that might not be enough. Albert Bourla spoke to US network CNBC.
A likely scenario is that there will be likely a need for a third dose. And then from there, there will be an annual revaccination, but all of that needs to be confirmed.
If that likelihood eventuates, it will put even more pressure on supply chains. Global supply already can't keep up with demand, and a huge part of Australia's population is relying on the Pfizer vaccine. It's the preferred option for everyone under 50. Associate Professor in Public Health from La Trobe University, Dr. Deborah Gleeson, thinks a need for three shots will delay Australia's rollout even further.
Well, the news that's come in overnight really represents another obstacle for our vaccine rollout. It's likely to put more pressure on the global supply of vaccines, which is already far short of what we need. For Australia, we have agreements in place for 40 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine, but we might face further delays in receiving those supplies. We may see our vaccine rollout pushed out further into 2021 or even 2022.
And she warns this global demand will only exacerbate inequities.
We've seen really staggering inequities in access at the global level, with one in four people now vaccinated in rich countries versus one in 500 in low-income countries.
Today in Australia, authorities are asking for calm as the death of a New South Wales woman in her 40s from blood clots is further investigated. She had recently been vaccinated against COVID-19. New South Wales Health says there's no confirmed link to the vaccine, but it's being looked into further. In a statement, the Therapeutic Goods Administration says the extremely rare blood clots connected to the AstraZeneca vaccine differ from common blood clots that occur in 50 Australians every day. In more than 700,000 Australians who have received the AstraZeneca shot, this clotting syndrome has affected two people. New South Wales Premier Glenys Berejiklian spoke to Channel 9.
The federal authorities are looking into these matters to see if there is that link. And in the meantime, we just extend our heartfelt condolences to the family and loved ones during this difficult time.
Annie Butler is the Federal Secretary of the Australian Nursing and Midwifery Federation.
There is no proof yet that there are any links between the vaccination and the death of this poor woman. And it is unfortunate that this individual's circumstances are getting discussed so publicly in the media like this. What we know, and we can be really confident in, is that the TGA and ATAGI, our national authorities who investigate these incidents and look at all immunisation matters, are completely independent, they're extremely rigorous, and they will look into the finding out whether there are any actual links. It's also important to know, unfortunately, these sorts of medical conditions happen daily to people all across the country. It's just that we're not aware of them.
On Monday, state, territory and federal leaders will begin regular meetings to get Australia's vaccine rollout back on track. Around 1.4 million doses have been administered around the country, but that's far short of previous targets set by the federal government. With winter around the corner, Annie Butler says urgency is needed more than ever.
What we would like to see is for the states and territories, the state health departments take over the responsibility and be fully funded for the vaccination rollout to the aged care workforce. We know that our aged care workers are just not getting vaccinated. They were meant to be in the 1A category. They were meant to be, you know, nearing completion now. We're heading into winter. We know that, and particularly from the COVID second wave here in Victoria, we know that aged care residents are the most vulnerable in our community. We need to get them vaccinated as quickly as possible. The federal government has not shown that they are doing that effectively, so we need the responsibility handed over.
Annie Butler from the Australian Nursing and Midwifery Federation, ending Sarah Sedgie's report. Professor Catherine Bennett is the chair in epidemiology at Deakin University, and I asked her what health authorities will be doing to try and see if there's a link between the death of the woman in New South Wales and the AstraZeneca vaccine.
The clotting disorder that's associated with the vaccine has a very, very distinctive clinical presentation. It's not like the normal clotting disorders that are actually quite common. TGA itself has said, you know, we have 50 or so a day that are reported. This is something that is not only rare, but it's actually very unique in the way it presents. So they'll be looking at a range of things, how long it took to develop post-vaccine, how the clinical picture was for the patient, what tests were done, and so on. So they will be able to learn from the clinical records for this patient what the story was, how it unfolded, and that should put them in a strong position to say whether it fits this particular unique type of clotting disorder, in which case that would then raise their suspicions that it might be associated with a vaccine.
How much do the doctors and scientists know so far about what may actually be causing this reaction, very rare reaction, to the AstraZeneca vaccine?
Well, it presents a bit like a very rare reaction that some people have to taking a blood thinner, ironically, you know, heparin, which is actually a very common drug used as blood thinning. And they think it might be something to do with an immune response, in that case initiated by heparin, in this case the AstraZeneca vaccine, perhaps the adenovirus, which is the sort of main vehicle used in the vaccine. And it just seems to switch something in those people where they start producing antibodies to their own platelets. So they actually have antibodies that then, you know, in the process of fixing on to these platelets, that they actually cause clumping of in the blood. And so it starts to form clots. And these particular cases that they've seen have this clotting forming in very specific parts of the body, including associated with the drainage from the abdomen, but also associated with the brain. So that's where they've got a clear picture of what's happening, but they're yet to really figure out the mechanism, and therefore not only what puts people at risk, but how you might identify this handful of people in a million that are at risk. That's the frustration.
What's your message then to people, perhaps in Australia, the over 50s, who may be balking at the prospect of getting a vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine, because of this blood clot concern?
Well, as I said, you know, we don't have big enough numbers to be very sure of the age-specific rates, but they certainly seem to drop away. And if you look at the people who are over 50, their rate of this occurring was only a quarter of that of people in their 20s, for example. And that's why we've focused on the younger groups in the Australian decision to modify, you know, what they call the preferred vaccine for those groups. So each decade, you know, it drops away.
Catherine Bennett, what's your reaction to the Pfizer CEO saying, as we've just heard, that it now seems likely a third booster may be needed to give adequate protection against the virus?
It's a really important part of the follow-up from not only the phase 3 trials, but also the real-world follow-up of people who are vaccinated, that we understand how long the protection lasts. And that's something that, you know, they were monitoring. They say, look good at 6 months. That's the last we officially heard. So we need to see those data. And so the chief executive coming out and suggesting you might need another jab within 12 months, possibly boosters annually, suggests that at least for the Pfizer, that they might be seeing signals that the immunity is starting to wane after a certain period of time, you know, in that second 6 month period. So we'll wait and see the data. This is something that was mentioned in a meeting, not backed up by data, and it hasn't been released to the world, but it'll be really important for us to look at those data because it will tell us how long the coverage can be expected to last and therefore what consequences that might have for, you know, ongoing need for booster shots. We thought originally you might not need boosters every year, but you might need an update if there was a bit of a shift in the virus circulating and you needed to have a modified, updated vaccine. But what he's suggesting is something more like, you know, you can only expect coverage to last up to 12 months and you'd need a booster. So we'll wait and see those results out of the follow-up of people who've had the vaccination and see how their antibodies are lasting in their system.
Professor Catherine Bennett, the Chair in Epidemiology at Deakin University. Well, staying with the virus, and health experts are urging governments to take a cautious approach on reopening Australia's international border. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has flagged the possibility that Australians could soon travel overseas for events like funerals or business as long as they're vaccinated. But some experts say this is just a way to entice Australians to get the jab. Catherine Gregory reports.
Australians' appetite for travel is huge, and despite the global pandemic, many are still hopeful they'll be jet-setting by next year.
They're still booking, yeah. I mean, people who cruise are very passionate about cruising and absolutely love it. And there are people making cruise bookings for 2022, for 2023 now. So there is a huge thirst, a huge appetite for going to overseas destinations. It's just that we can't really do too much of it at the moment.
Ben Groundwater is a travel writer for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. A tough gig at the moment.
Look, it's not the ideal industry to be in, I can say that.
So the Prime Minister's proposal that vaccinated Australians could soon travel overseas for things like funerals or business is certainly appealing, particularly the idea that returning travellers wouldn't have to quarantine in a hotel, rather their home. He warns that could mean thousands of COVID cases, but hopes it would test the viability and safety of opening our borders for other types of travel. But Ben Groundwater thinks too many people would be at a disadvantage.
When politicians are saying you'll need to be vaccinated to be able to do that, and obviously there's only a finite group of people at the moment who have been vaccinated and who are likely to be vaccinated given the issues with the AstraZeneca vaccine and the delays that we've had with vaccine rollout, which still leaves a huge amount of Australians who won't be vaccinated probably this year, who are going to be a little bit frustrated about seeing others being allowed to go overseas on holidays or you know, on these trips that are deemed important and come back and quarantine at home rather than in a hotel. And I think it's going to create a system for one and a system for another type of people, which is going to it sort of goes against the way Australians see travel and the travel experience, I think.
He also thinks the priority should be getting Australians stranded overseas back home. Defence Minister Peter Dutton told Channel 9 this morning that's also on the cards.
If we can get people away from hotel quarantine into home quarantine and people do the right thing, then you can scale up the numbers obviously much more significantly than if we're just relying on hotels.
Labor's Deputy Leader Richard Marles thinks the PM's idea of a slow border reopening is unrealistic. He also spoke to Channel 9.
We've got to get the population vaccinated. I mean, this is the Prime Minister trying to get through another press conference in the heat of the moment.
Health experts have said international travel is probably off the cards for at least another year, given uncertainty around vaccines and the emergence of new COVID-19 strains overseas. One of those is Dr. Karen Phelps, the former president of the Australian Medical Association. She says Scott Morrison's proposal is jumping the gun.
If we open the borders too early, then we could be facing the same sort of catastrophic results that were seen with uncontrolled viral spread in other countries.
And she thinks the PM might be doing a bit of a carrot and stick exercise.
I'm sure that the Prime Minister is well aware of the public health and epidemiological advice about the dangers of opening the borders. The quote about having to get your head around 1,000 cases of COVID a week in Australia, I'm not sure why that was mentioned. I'm sort of wondering whether it's just a reminder to people that if they can be vaccinated, that they do make sure that they have the vaccine.
Dr. Phelps says the slow vaccine rollout in Australia really delays any form of international travel, and even a vaccinated population isn't a foolproof solution.
I think we need to be looking at issues like transmissibility of the virus in people who've been vaccinated, because we don't yet know just how infectious somebody who has had the vaccine and still gets the infection might be to other people. So if someone was to be vaccinated, I think that might lull us into a false sense of security.
The way you're talking there, it seems that maybe we'll never return to the days of international travel that we once had.
In terms of fully rejoining the international community, it's going to be a slow process. And the reports we heard out of Brazil in the recent days about the numbers of young children, babies in intensive care unit and dying from COVID, shocking and alarming. We don't have a vaccine for babies and children at this stage.
On the proposal of home quarantine for returning travellers and stranded Australians, Dr. Phelps thinks it's far too risky.
Well, we had a little trial with home quarantining in Victoria, you'll recall, and when there was door knocking done to check if people were home, a very significant number of people who were supposed to be home quarantining weren't actually at home, which is why the hotel quarantining had to be introduced. So no, I don't think that is something that's been successful because it's been tried. I do think we're going to have a form of monitored quarantining for some time to come.
Dr. Karen Phelps, a former AMA president, ending that report from Catherine Gregory. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Well, it's certainly been a traumatic week for the residents of Kalbarri on the West Australian coast. Much of the holiday town was decimated by tropical cyclone Seroja on Sunday night, and since then locals have been dealing with isolation, blackouts, and of course a monumental clean-up. Workers are still trying to restore electricity to nearly 6,000 homes and businesses across the state's Midwest and Wheatbelt regions. Shane Cracker is the Deputy President of the Northamptonshire. He's in Kalbarri and I spoke to him a short time ago.
The SES have done a wonderful job in starting to clean it up. There's still a lot of rubbish around, but it's starting to pick up. Western Power are here, and they are really doing a great job. They've already started. So things are starting to move, but the asbestos issue is a big problem. People's backyards are full of it, of other roofs and stuff. And that's becoming a big issue because people are scared of the asbestos issue.
And are the SES crews able to handle that, or do they need to bring in specialist workers?
Specialist workers have got to come in and remove this all this asbestos.
Is there any sign that those specialist teams will be able to come in anytime soon to help you out?
Well, I haven't heard anything as yet, but this has only come up in the last couple of days. The other thing is accommodation. We're trying to get accommodation going for people, workers to come in, and that's the big issue.
And what about accommodation for people who've lost their homes, Shane? Is that hard to find at the moment, or people bunking in with other friends and family?
A lot of that's happening, and a lot of people like the Australian Nurses Federation have given up all their units at the Kalbarri Beach Resort for accommodation to people. So there's a lot of people trying to help people, taking people in. I've got people coming here and having showers at my house because I've got big generators and that here as well. It's just everybody's trying to help each other.
And have you been given any estimate as to when you may get the power back?
No, we haven't. The boys have turned up. There's a crew of about 40, I think, and they're up the end of my street now rolling up cables and starting. What their plan, I think, is to get the town rewired, and we've got four massive generators that belong to Western Power, and they might be able to repower the town, but that could be a week to 10 days. I don't know.
And how are the locals coping overall, do you feel?
It's all new to everybody because this has never happened before. I think they're going pretty well. The police are doing a lot of meetings, town meetings, talking to people, and everybody's, you know, they're trying to look after them all. Our medical centre has got a brilliant staff, and they're going around checking on all the older people. It's like we've just, everybody's had to throw out all their food out of their houses because we've had no power for so long and the fridges are all gone. So, you know, they're getting fed, they're getting looked after.
Who's bringing the food into town and getting it out to people?
I've got a cafe as well, but they've got a free food stall out the front of my cafe, which I don't mind because at this stage it's, and people have been coming to there getting food or they come to our cafe. We've been giving good, pretty good deals out to everybody because there's only one or two cafes open in town because there's no power and they've all lost their roofs.
And I understand the Prime Minister is due in town today. What do you think the townspeople want to get across to the Prime Minister?
Well, I don't know what you can say. Everything you can see is it's all there. You know, there's nothing left. I don't know how many houses are going to – I was quite shocked speaking to people yesterday. The houses I thought were okay, they're going to bulldoze. You know, there's a lot of houses are going to – especially around the foreshore area, the beautiful houses have gone. They're structurally not safe anymore.
What's the feeling amongst the Kalbarri residents? Are people keen to stay and rebuild, or do you think some people will move on?
I think there'll be a bit of hit and miss. Some people have moved out already. The ones that have had their houses destroyed have gone. I think they'll be back. A lot of people will never leave. You know, it was a beautiful place and it still is, but we've just got to rebuild it and it's just going to take time. Between everybody, I hope we can do that.
Shane Cracker, the Deputy President of the Northamptonshire in WA, he was speaking to me from Kalbarri. Well, tomorrow is shaping up as yet another big day for the rise in prominence of women's sport in this country. It's the AFLW Grand Final. The Adelaide Crows are taking on the Brisbane Lions, and this year's decider is set to be a real cause for celebration after last year's final was cancelled because of the pandemic. Nicole Livingston is the General Manager of Women's Football at the AFL. She told David Sparks tomorrow's game is another landmark moment.
It's very exciting, particularly given the 2020 year and the fact that we didn't actually get to award a premier. So it's been one of our motivating forces this year through a pretty complex national landscape with borders and COVID to make sure that we not only got the full season away, but we got to this day, which is the grand final day.
So this is season 5 of the AFLW. It's been a juggernaut. It was, I guess, such a mission to get it up and running. Tell me about the development and how you think the league has progressed in those 5 years.
Well, there have been 5 short years. Sometimes I feel like long years. I've been on board with the AFL since just after the first season, which, you know, landed with such great support from the community. You know, the very first game, it goes down as a bit of folklore, I guess, that, you know, they couldn't fit as many people as wanted to come to see that Carlton-Collingwood game, the opening match in 2017. So since that time, I feel like we have grown up and I feel like we have matured. And, you know, this year, as an example, is the first year that we've had ticketing. It's also the first year that we've gone this deep into the men's season. So I feel like in year 5, my experience of going to the football and watching and listening is that people are going along, and there's a mix. People going along to support women, people going along to support women's football, but more generally, people are going to the footy to watch footy. And it sounds the same as the AFL men's competition when I go now. So it's not necessarily that they're seeing the gender. They're in there, they're watching footy and they're cheering on their team and they're seeing the contest and the battle. And for me, that shows us that this is a legitimate league, that people are grabbing hold of it and barracking for it, supporting it, critiquing it and criticising it like they do the men's competition.
I remember when the league first took off 5 years ago, everyone was saying this could really help inspire young girls. They'll see these professional female athletes doing this and it'll inspire them, maybe not just in sport but in other areas of life. I mean, do you Yes. think the AFLW has achieved that? Has it reached girls and affected the way they see the world?
Well, we haven't got to our final destination, but I think it is inspiring women, but importantly, it is assisting with the way that women are treated, the way that they're accepted, the way that they're included in football clubs right across the country. So it's not just about looking at our 14 AFLW clubs, and we are the largest employer employer of female athletes in this country with 420 signed to play football, which is just incredible. If you think about that opportunity, there's opportunity for women away from football. If they're not good at kicking the sherrin, there's opportunity in administration, in coaching, in umpiring. And we do need to get better with that. But, you know, I think it is not only increasing the opportunity, but it's also increasing the way that men are seeing women in our community.
Nicole Livingston, the General Manager of Women's Football at the AFL. She was speaking to David Sparks. And that's The World Today for this week. Sally Sara will be back with you at the same time on Monday. I'm Samantha Donovan. I hope you have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Joe Biden made it very clear from the outset that handling the pandemic in America was number one on his to-do list. So nearly 3 months into his term as president, how's he doing?
Today on The Signal, after some early wins against the virus, America's luck seems to have turned, with COVID transmission on the rise again. So what's gone wrong, and can Biden turn it around before it becomes a fourth wave? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.